Okay. Let's find out what happened with this patient.
Okay. So neoadjuvant therapy, full Firi, Avastin. I have a little bit Axel's argument. And actually this patient, a PR, minimal PR.
And what was the thinking about using neoadjuvant therapy?
I think that in resectable patients, I mean, I think there's a good argument for it. That is, you can tailor the response of therapy postoperatively, particularly a patient that's seen remote prior chemotherapy. So is this patient, do we offer any chemotherapy? If this patient was stable or progressed, then still resect and perhaps offer no chemotherapy postoperatively. So that's one advantage. I think we gain some biologic information about that this patient's prognosis is better than if they didn't respond this way. And I think this patient gets chemotherapy earlier than if they had resection.
So was this patient presented in an interdisciplinary conference?
Yes.
And what was the sentiment coming out of it? Is that generally what you're doing? Are patients resectable or get neoadjuvant therapy?
I think they're individualized. It's kind of a 50-50 in our view. I think we generally have a philosophy that neoadjuvant therapy, when you can do it, has an advantage. And so we generally favor it, but I would say for most patients. This one, too, there was some feeling that the odds of response were still pretty good and this patient could be saved an extended right epitectomy more likely and more likely get a negative margin at the medial edge. So I think there were some technical reasons to favor, actually, neoadjuvant here, although one could go either way.
Mike, if you had made that statement earlier in our discussion, you know, we would have probably all favored some form of neoadjuvant therapy because it's really, and this is the critical issue when we talk to surgeons is, in some ways, you make the call because we are just kind of providing a tool to potentially help you facilitate
surgery.
We're
the janitors.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's not, it's your call. I mean, you cannot hide behind this, you know. This is your call whether or not chemotherapy is feasible.
One of my insights on this is that we argue a lot about how to manage the patient. Should the surgeon be the first manager or the medical oncologist be the first manager? And I'm not sure that it makes a huge difference in most cases. And it'll be interesting to see what the trial that NSABP has proposed will show, which is, you know, immediate surgery versus perioperative chemo before and after surgery. But in many ways, I think the next step of this is to be looking at whole genome scanning and molecular markers, because we all have in our practices patients with 7 liver mets who get resected and never recur, and 1 liver met who gets resected, and with the next scan that you do, 3 months later, they got 5 more mets. And it's hard for us, I think, to predict who's going to be in which camp. And the only answer to that I can think of is it isn't the radiologist, it isn't the FONG data on prognosis, it's the tumors and the tumors' physiology that we have to understand better.
I want to expand on the issue. Maybe since we brought up that trial, Mike, if you could just sort of update us.
Well, the question we're just discussing is the sequencing question, and the Norlinger study really didn't answer the sequencing in spite of the fact that perhaps you showed that there may be an increasing trend because of that trial to give chemotherapy preoperatively. I think the jury is completely still out, and I think there's some pushback that, in fact, that trial didn't show a tremendous benefit, and it showed some toxicity. So some have been interpreting that. In fact, perhaps that's evidence to support going earlier to surgery. So the bottom line is that the jury is still out regarding the sequencing, although most feel as though there's certainly a role for adjuvant, neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So the question we're thinking about is, as we're all talking about, what order do you do it? And there are certain camps that believe one versus the other. So the trial we're thinking of is just this asking, for the primary endpoint of sequencing question, the same regimen of chemotherapy, do you give it in a split course before and after versus all after in an adjuvant setting? And here, at least in the design phase, we're thinking about how to explore the biologics by stratifying patients based on RAS testing pre-op, and then if they're RAS wild type, then they would get FOLFOX with 225, either randomized to peri or post. And if they're RAS mutated, then FOLFOX Bev, although that's still on the table as far as the details.
Who are the key organizations and investigators that are talking about this right now?
Initially, it was brought forth through ACOSOG, but now it's been kind of taken over by NSABP. So I'm the study chair, but along with various others, we've had at least verbal interest from a variety of cooperative centers, including all the cooperative centers actually have expressed interest in supporting the trial.
To downstage people that don't need downstage and give them therapy they don't need, get more complications than they should have. And if I were thinking about this study, if you look at the METRI data that's published for just 5-FU and leucovorin, it looks every bit as good as FOLFOX pre and post. I think I'd rather see a study with the Bev and cetuximab. That even makes it more complicated. I'd wait for all the Bev studies to come out in the adjuvant setting to see whether it has any impact whatsoever from C08 and the AVANT trial. But in my head, I think that I'd rather see people just randomize between FOLFOX and FOLFOX cetuximab post-op just in the wild-type patients.
So what happened at surgery?
Central hepatectomy went fine.
Margin. Can I interrupt you for 1 second? I'd actually like to ask Chan and Fergus before that. You know, one of my observations when you look at these sorts of tumors that's relevant to RECIST criteria in clinical trials is that when I look at this, it looks like there's potentially liquefactive necrosis in the center of the tumor. The density of the what used to be the tumor is the same as the density of the liquid in the stomach. And so I'd like to actually have you predict of this 4-by-3-centimeter tumor, how much of it is going to be viable when the pathologist gets a look at it.
Fergus?
I mean, it looks pretty cystic in the center with just a rim of tumor at the outside. And, you know, I think it speaks to the fact that looking at tumor size alone is fairly incomplete in terms of telling you what's happened in terms of response. And that's why we're, as imagers, very interested in molecular imaging and using PET and SUVs and looking beyond simply size to tell you what's going on with the tumor, because I think your observation's absolutely right. It looks substantially necrotic now from the chemo.
What do you think, Chan?
I totally agree with Fergus. And I think we're learning that, particularly with the biologics, that they induce this pretty impressive central non-vascularity. The amount of viable tissue, I think, is a bit of a guess, and I don't know how the pathologists do it, whether they just look at the rim and make the assessment on that, or whether they section the whole thing and then give you a number.
Rich, do you think this is about biologics? When we did this GIST symposium, we had a couple cases like this where what you just described, it really actually didn't even change size. Do you think that's more characteristic of biologics?
Well, I think it's more characteristic of better imaging tools, that we now have better definition of the tumor, and the crude, let's put a caliper on it, that is the basis of all of our response rates and progression-free survival, needs to be rethought, because I think we're seeing biologic changes that are more complicated than just a caliper can assess.
And this is something that's been done for a long time with sarcomas. Typically, see on a report X percentage of viable tumor, but you never see that in a resected colon cancer after therapy.
So what was seen in this patient in terms of, was it necrotic?
Still evident tumor. There was still viable. It wasn't a pathologic.
But was there a lot of necrotic tissue in there?
Wasn't a lot of steatosis or steatohepatitis, and she did fine.
What do we know about predicting steatosis and changes in the liver from chemotherapy, Steve, in terms of, are the agents and regimens different? Is it the duration of the chemo? What are the factors?
Well, the answer is yes to both. It is agent dependent. Again, I'll defer to Chan and Fergus, but you can see changes on CT. You can see steatosis. You can see what this looks like, a very normal appearing liver based on this. A steatotic liver is going to be much less dense. You're going to see a loss in some of the vascularity.
And do you see that actually happen as you get chemo?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So Fergus, the scan actually changes?
Yeah, and we see it a lot more in the when they were seeing a lot of 5-FU, that would cause a lot of fatty liver, and it was actually could fake you out, because a measurable metastasis could become almost invisible and not measurable because the liver next to it becomes low density and starts to be the same density as the tumor. The other problem, speaking about biologics, is sometimes you can get almost what I call pseudo-progression, where a previously isodense tumor changes its vascularity, and all of a sudden you can see it as a low-density lesion, and you have to be careful not to call it a new tumor. And that's another pitfall that we've kind of recognized in recent years. And Chan, I'm not sure if you've seen that as well.
But yeah, we've seen it too. Yeah.
Alan?
And to emphasize, the 5-FU fatty liver is not a new story. So when people used to get a year of 5-FU as an adjuvant, it was well known that if you scanned them at that time, many had fatty livers.
Right.
So this, I think, may be a 5-FU effect.
What's the mechanism?
Well, it's irinotecan-based as well. Irinotecan-based regimens with 5-FU, particularly Fulfiri, are the most profound changes we see.
The mechanism, I don't know what the mechanism is.
Is it just direct toxic effect on hepatocytes? Do we know anything about why this happens?
Well, with irinotecan, we're seeing not only steatosis, but we're seeing steatohepatitis. So there you're actually getting a portal triaditis. You're actually getting inflammatory changes in the liver. And again, Nick Vote from our group published a paper showing that if you have actual steatohepatitis and proceed with a liver resection, then you actually have an increased not only perioperative morbidity, but a higher perioperative mortality rate. In contrast, oxaliplatin calls what we like to anecdotally call the blue liver syndrome. And literally, the liver has a nice blue hue to it. They get a sinusoidal, venocytosinusoidal dilatation, sinusoidal changes. Again, that liver is not a lot of fun to operate on. It's literally kind of a soft, mushy liver. But we're able to do those cases without an increased risk to the patient in terms of perioperative mortality or liver failure. Steatohepatitis is very concerning because there is a higher incidence of liver insufficiency and liver failure in those patients.
What about biologics?
Biologics, again, most of the patients we see are being treated with bevacizumab. I would have to consider our experience there somewhat anecdotal. And as I said, we know from our data we can do those patients with no increase in morbidity or mortality. We are seeing some strange complications. We have seen a slightly higher increase of postoperative portal venous thrombosis.
How about myelomas?
In patients who get bevacizumab. I've had a couple of arterial thromboses in those patients.
You mentioned myelomas?
Yeah, we think we're seeing more myelomas.
Have not seen that in our experience. Yeah. We track that. All of our patients are on a prospective database, and we haven't seen that.
Is there, Axel, sort of a, I don't know, way you sort of think this through in terms of what's a, quote, safe amount of neoadjuvant therapy in terms of duration and choice?
Yeah. I think that's one of the critical points we have to point out is that duration matters. I mean, the more we treat, the more we inflict changes to the liver architecture. And even for oxaliplatin, although we always say, you know, it's better than irinotecan, but we have seen patients who actually had to be treated longer for conversion therapy and so necessitated further treatment where a surgeon went in and said, you know, really can't do anything. Sometimes you see portal hypertension, spleen gets large, you see thrombocytopenia, etc. So the shorter the better. And this is, I think, very critical. I don't think there is one safe margin. It really depends on other patient factors like BMI, diabetes, gender might play a role, age might play a role, other toxic nutritions, for instance, patients might have had. But for, let's say, a normal liver, if I want to test the chemotherapy responsiveness of a cancer, I really just give, let's say, 3 or 4 cycles, perhaps even 2 cycles, just to say the tumor responds, and then we go on to resection. In a patient that needs to have longer therapy to convert unresectable to resectable, the shorter the better. And there's where the interdisciplinary approach comes into play.
So, Rich, this patient comes to you for a second opinion after surgery, mm-hmm. and you hear this story. She's gotten 4 cycles of Fulfiri Bev, had a response, had a resection, and wants to know, what about more therapy at this point?
Yeah, I'd probably give the option to go either way. You have the additional data in this circumstance that the tumor did respond. I would ask the pathologist, you know, was this a dramatic response, a near complete response? Was there a lot more necrosis? Because the way it was initially described was that there was a modest response to chemotherapy. I think it may have been more than modest. How does that figure into your decision whether to give 6 more cycles of Fulfiri on the other side? You know, I think when you talk to the patient, you can say, well, we aren't sure whether more treatment's going to help you. How beat up are you feeling? How aggressive do you want to be? We know that the chemotherapy had an impact on your disease, and it may be that more of it will make the difference between cure and recurrence, but we don't know for sure.
Steve, what would you likely be recommending in this situation?
I would have pretty much the same discussion. If the patient asked me, well, what would you tell me to do, I would probably say, because you've had a good response, you don't have evidence of liver toxicity, presumably the patient tolerated the preoperative therapy well, that I would go ahead and try to complete a somewhat standard adjuvant course of chemotherapy with the Fulfiri.
So that would be 4 pre-op and then 6 post-op?
6 to 8, yeah.
Okay, so what happened?
She got an additional 6 to 8 with Avastin, same regimen she got before. So far, she's NED.
How far out is she right now?
She's about a year.
P Peter, I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts there are after having heard this case discussed and looking at, you know, the beginnings of how we might present the way people approach these cases.
You know, I think this is a useful exercise. I mean, it shows that there's legitimate disagreement, not major disagreement, because I think it does all center on whether or not the patient's curable. Basically, it's going to educate the average oncologist who looks at that, or I shouldn't say the average one, but the 20% who still haven't had the word that just because this patient's got bilobar disease, they shouldn't ever think about being sent to a surgeon. It'll educate them. By the way, I want to mention just one thing in passing. Just somebody else might look at this and read it. You know, the NCCN guidelines, believe it or not, would include for this patient the possibility of an ablation.
Guilty as charged. I sit on the NCCN guidelines so panel, and the problem, the good news and the bad news about NCCN's guideline process is that all it takes is one person to believe that something is an acceptable alternative, and unless there's a Donnybrook, that gets into the guidelines. I'm not happy about this, but the reason this is that many insurers are using the NCCN guidelines to make decisions. And so could you envision a patient with a lesion where RFA might be appropriate? And so when you have the debate, the answer is, well, you could envision a scenario where that might be a reasonable step.
Which would be?
Well, let's say a cirrhotic patient with cirrhosis or a patient with a lot of comorbidities who can't undergo a hepatic resection, where RFA might be reasonable.
You agree, Steve?
Yeah, that's the one time I would, for a solitary lesion like this, do I have some patients who, you know, have bad livers, they've got bad hearts, they don't clear, they're an ASA 3, 2 or 3 risk? Sure, would we consider an ablation in that
case?
And
so the guidelines need to be all-encompassing, and so that's the flaw in the guidelines.
Just to defend the NCCN guidelines, because I'm on the panel as well, this would not be a candidate. This says this is a resectable patient.
Right.
The guidelines clearly say in tumors that are ineligible for resection or comorbid disease
right.
ineligible for resection, and also that are candidates for ablation, a large tumor like that, in the guidelines say clearly this is not a candidate for ablation.
Yeah, and here by definition, you're saying you can get a radiologic margin. So yeah, I agree.
Correct.
On the NCCN
right,
guidelines, that would not be. Now, again, the other place
print.
I would is, right. let's say you've got a central liver lesion that's unresectable, meaning it is stuck right up there under all three veins. Those are patients we will consider sometimes for ablation. The data on whether or not it's a benefit is dubious at best, but again, oftentimes patients are going to drive that process. And again, you can then ask the question, should they get neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy around an ablation? Once again, we have no hard data on that, but that's frequently done out in the real world.
And Neil, the other thing that's spinning out of control, it's not just our interventional radiology people, it's the radiation oncologists. They're doing CyberKnife on some of these lesions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I find this, in many circumstances, outrageous, but this is a growth industry for some of these modalities. You guys have...
We've got a guy who opened up a practice 20 miles away from our hospital who is doing CyberKnife therapy on these lesions that are resectable.
Wow.
And once again, I'm probably seeing 10, 12 of those patients a year after he, you know...
They're really easy to resect after that, aren't they?
Oh, the liver loves that. The liver loves a little radiation
therapy. Well, they have to
therapy,
push the douchial... I mean, you know, the process... So this is the other thing. I think this tool... saying what isn't appropriate as well as what is appropriate.
I just had a quick question. In terms of the algorithm of treating people and if they progress through chemotherapy to think maybe you shouldn't operate on them, does that data set from Renee, isn't that primarily from the conversion therapy people?
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily true, because if you look at the Nord-Léger trial, in fact, very few people did not get surgery because their tumor grew.
Correct.
Well, and Renee will admit, if you ask him directly, even patients who do progress, he still resects, because while in his reported data, there was an 8% five-year survival, you know, it's 8%. And he admits that it was a very highly skewed, and it was a retrospective review.
And that's more than 4 metastases.
Right, exactly. So he still resects those patients.